Welcome and hello. This is November 20th, 2023. Our time today for the study and video is 21:39 hours Eastern Standard Time. Ward Green with you. Once again, we're studying the Born and Raised article, and now we're on Chapter 12, Paragraph 2. It's late today. Anyone who mentions a specific year in history, this paragraph begins, who has not studied that chronology cannot be taken seriously. Nebuchadnezzar, year 1, BCE 604, is undeniably a reality. The 70 years prophesied to be fulfilled at Babylon had to do with Babylon's world dominance begun in BCE 608 and announced as fulfilled in year 1 BCE 538 of Cyrus. This is what we have maintained in our account of Jehovah's true chronology, which we call the genealogy. These dates are, of course, related to the dates of King Solomon and dates of Jesus, as we read already above. Now, not only do the scriptures agree with history, but they are also in agreement with culture and custom, or at least a faithful one is justified in expecting that cultural realities be manifested in an honest account. The writers of the gospel accounts must have known the Jewish customs very well, the Pharisees differing from the Sadducees, and both of them also from the Essenes. These sects had, as we believe, vehement disagreements with one another, and Jesus argued with the first two. To be clear, there's nothing in the Gospels about the Essenes in any explicit way upon which we can comment. Does this mean that Jesus was an Essene, or that Jesus shared some of his beliefs with them? We might wonder. At the risk of being accused of neglect, we should now ignore any differences between these sects that do not illuminate our topic, which is the crucifixion. More specifically, we are interested in the passion of Christ connected with the week of crucifixion. By this, we are not implying that the passion is a full week in length, but that the week in which this period occurred may possibly be uniquely determinable. We are interested in this because if this week is in fact uniquely determinable, let's say in terms of the Julian calendar, for example, like what days of April or March or whatever month it is, then we can happily, if we know the exact dates in that calendar, then we can happily uniquely identify, we can happily uniquely exactly identify the year of the crucifixion. If we could determine, well, because it's a Bible event, it would be determined if we could determine it in terms of the Jewish calendar, for example. That would be the most likely thing, and then we could convert that into, we could figure out what year it must have occurred. But we'd have to know what the Julian dates were, yeah, before we could say for sure those Julian dates can only line up with those particular Jewish dates in this one particular year. So that's the key there. We could do that if we were given the day of the week. Say, let's say we were told it was a Friday or a Wednesday or whatever. If we were told what day it was, and we knew what Jewish day of the month it was, what day of the Jewish month, that would uniquely determine what year it was if we were looking within a very narrow range of years. Having already considered it at length, anyone who studies this knows what I'm talking about. it's not a difficult concept. I already know what I believe the answer is, in terms of what year it was, and am merely seeking to announce the, quote, delightful and accurate words of truth from Ecclesiastes 12 and 10, for example. The end quote, rather. That's the end of the quote. Delightful and accurate words of truth, end quote. Just as we seek the advice of chronologers, and this is important, when making a chronology out of secular history, one appropriately seeks Jewish insight to decipher the sects of Judaism, or more particularly, Passover, quote-unquote Passover, for the Jewish sects. The word Passover being in quotations, because it depended what sect you were, when Passover would occur. It was dependent on the sect. They didn't celebrate or perform the rituals or the observe is the right word, I guess, Passover on the same day if they were in different sects. So this is where we're going to get into some very difficult, they're not conceptually difficult things, but they're confusing, easy, very things that are very that can very easily cause confusion. That's what it is. We're going to talk about some things that can easily cause confusion. Okay, that's coming in the next study, in the next paragraphs of that article. And that's all for today. But that's coming up, hopefully. That hopefully we'll be able to understand it better and explain it so that anyone can understand it, I hope. But it's not going to be easy. Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 7 is our scripture, little ones, for today. All the hard work of mankind is for their mouth, but even their soul, which would be good enough. It would be good enough to say even their soul does not get filled. But that's not what it says. It says even their own soul does not get filled. And what does it say in the study version? Yet his appetite is never satisfied. So when mankind, when a man does work, a human being, this is saying that all of his hard work is to put food in his mouth, or to give him good food, to make sure he can buy the best food possible for his consumption. But that's an interesting statement to say that. But it also could mean spiritual food, so he can obtain access to the best movies, books, and all these sorts of things. That is spiritual. Spiritual things are what's the word? Not spiritual. Figuratively, their figurative mouth, so they can eat spiritual food. But even their own soul does not get filled. So that's curious. Since we can never fill our own soul with either physical food, with neither physical food nor with spiritual food, we can never get completely filled. It shows that's why the hard work is vanity, as Ecclesiastes repeats over and over in its contents of the continual message of the book of Ecclesiastes, is that all is vanity. Everything is for, essentially no purpose. It comes to nothing, or it's vain. But even in the case of hard work being to fill our mouths, our own soul does not get filled. Uh-huh. Our lives are never completely full in all these ways of, mental, physical, social, spiritual, financial health is never fully manifested, you could say. It's a fascinating and important concept. I think we would probably all agree, as many of us as are mature, Now, in 1 Samuel, at length, chapter 19, Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all his servants of putting David to death. But let's read the commentary that Clark gives. Perhaps. I'm torn between reading the commentary and actually reading, because he discusses everything. David complains to Jonathan of Saul's enmity against him. Jonathan comforts him. They walk out into the field and renew their covenant. David asks Jonathan's leave to absent himself from Saul's court, and Jonathan informs him how he shall ascertain the disposition of his father towards him. David hides himself, is missed by Saul. Jonathan is questioned concerning his absence, makes an excuse for David. Saul is enraged and endeavors to kill Jonathan. Jonathan goes out to the field, gives David the sign which they had agreed on, and by which he was to know that the king had determined to take away his life. He sends his servant back into the city, and then he and David meet, renew their covenant, and have a very affectionate parting. That's the contents. 1 Samuel 19, at length Saul spoke to Jonathan his son, and to all his servants of putting David to death. As for Jonathan, Saul's son, he took great delight in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to have you put to death. And now be on your guard, please, in the morning, and you must dwell in secrecy and keep yourself hidden. And I, for my part, shall go out and certainly stand at the side of my father in the field, where you will be, and I myself shall speak for you to my father, and I shall certainly see what will happen, and I shall be sure to tell you. Accordingly, Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father, and said to him, Do not let the king sin against his servant David, for he has not sinned toward you, and his works have been very good toward you. And he proceeded to put his soul in his palm and strike the Philistine down, so that Jehovah performed a great salvation for all Israel. I wrote a song years ago, and it goes touching. One of the lines in the song is touching only those who bring their being in their palm. And when I wrote that, I don't think I had any clue about the Bible and what it says about the palm. In this same way about the soul. Where does it say it? I can't find it. Oh yeah, he put his soul in his palm. And I don't know if I knew this or not. I certainly wasn't reading the Bible in those days, but I wrote the song about all those who bring their being in their palm. It touches only those. This special message the song was writing about touches only those who bring their being in their palm. You saw it, the salvation that David brought, and you gave way to rejoicing, Jonathan said to King Saul, his father. So why should you sin against innocent blood in having David put to death for nothing? Then Saul obeyed the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, as Jehovah is living, he will not be put to death. Afterward, Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words. Then Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he continued before him the same as formerly. In time, war broke out again, and David went sallying forth and fighting against the Philistines and striking them down with a great slaughter, and they took to flight from before him. And Jehovah's bad spirit came to be upon Saul when he was sitting in his house with a spear in his hand, while David was playing music with his hand. Consequently, Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he dodged from before Saul, so that he struck the spear into the wall. And David himself fled that he might escape during that night. Later, Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch it, and to have him put to death in the morning. Did we read this already? Just a minute. I think we read it already. Okay, that was yesterday's reading. How could I have forgotten that? Doesn't make sense. And David went running away after he went to Naoth. In 19... Okay, the end of chapter... I read the wrong thing. And now we've wasted all that time. Yeah, Saul, is Saul also among the prophets? But for anyone who missed the study yesterday, that's a refresher of it. And David went running away from Naoth to Ramah. I'm looking at 20 here. All right. I've already given you the summary. Right. David went running away from Naoth to in Ramah. Not to Ramah, but from Naoth in Ramah, David ran away. However, he came and said in front of Jonathan, "What have I done?" Naoth in Ramah was where they had been. "What have I done?" David said to Jonathan, "What is my error and what sin have I committed before your father, for he's seeking for my soul?" At this he said to him, "It is unthinkable. You will not die. Look, my father will not do a big thing or a little thing and not disclose it to my ear. And for what reason should my father conceal this matter from me? This does not happen." But David swore in addition and said, "Your father must surely know that I have found favor in your eyes, and so would say, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, for fear he may feel hurt.' But in fact, as Jehovah is living and as your soul is living, there is about a step between me and death." So, and Jonathan went on to say to David, "Whatever your soul may say, I shall do for you." At this, David said to Jonathan, "Look, tomorrow is new moon." Look at that. They know the they know about the new moons. They know about the months being based on the moon, of course. "And I myself ought, without fail, to be sitting with the king to eat. And you must send me away, and I must conceal myself in the field until the evening of the third day. On the third day, if your father should miss me at all, then you must say, 'David earnestly asked leave of absence of me to run to Bethlehem, his city,' which would be a lie, because there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family." Sounds like that they were sure that was just a lie. "If the way he should say is, 'It is all right,' if Saul says that, it means peace to your servant. But if he should at all become angry, know that what is bad has been determined upon by him, and you must render loving kindness toward your servant, for it is into a covenant of Jehovah that you have brought your servant with you. But if there is error in me, put me to death yourself." This is David speaking. "Since why should it be to your father that you should bring me?" Right. That was David telling Saul's son Jonathan to lie to his father, basically, and make up the story here of why David isn't there. "To this Jonathan said, 'That is unthinkable respecting you.'" But of course David was worried that Saul would kill him if he didn't do something drastic, like, you know, avoid seeing Saul. "To this Jonathan said, 'That is unthinkable respecting you, but if I should at all get to know what evil has been determined upon by my father to come upon you, shall I not tell it to you?' And so on. So they arranged a sign where Jonathan would send arrows and he would say something specific about the arrows to his servant in a coded message that his servant didn't know. But David was hiding in the field and he knew what it meant. And Jonathan thereby was able to warn Saul that because Saul had gotten angry at Jonathan, tried to kill Jonathan, when he found David wasn't there, you see. So So Saul said to Jonathan, "Why has not the son of Jesse," verse 27, "come to the meal, either yesterday or today?" David missed two meals. And Jonathan told the story they'd agreed on, that David had gone to Bethlehem. Then Saul's anger grew hot against Jonathan. And he said, "Do I not well know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame?" And Saul indicated David was destined for death, even though he'd already promised he would not kill David. So Saul was not a man of his word, evidently. But when Jonathan said, "Why should David be put to death? What has he done?" Saul tried to kill Jonathan, throwing the spear at Jonathan. So Jonathan rose up, verse 34, in the heat of anger, and he did not eat bread on that day. And then he made his way out the next day to meet with David on the third day. And he gave the message to the attendant by saying that the arrows were, are they not further on? That was the message that Saul had determined to kill David. When the attendant went to fetch the arrows, Jonathan gave this message by saying to the attendant, aren't the arrows further away? And that indicated to David that Saul, Jonathan's father, was intent on killing David. So, then Jonathan and David began kissing each other, verse 41, and weeping for each other, because they would now part. And David would not be in the company of Saul anymore, and that would mean he would not be seeing Jonathan either. And that's the end of 1 Samuel 20. Okay. But it's useful to read it. It's very useful to read it, but we just don't have that much time necessarily, nor do we necessarily need to read all the... Well, I mean, yes, you do. If you've never read it before, and if you're interested in any way, certainly, you should read it, and you need to read it. If you've never read it before, probably you should, and you probably do need to read it at some point just to know what it says, just to learn what the way in which it was that people wrote back in those days and how they spoke to each other. It's very, very informative in that way. So we had a bit of a review of 1 Samuel 19 also, but I would like to read Jeremiah 24. It's very short. Very short. It says, Jehovah showed me, and look, two baskets of figs set before the temple of Jehovah. After Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried into exile Jeconiah, or short for Jehoiakim. It's short for Coniah. Jeconiah is short for Coniah, but Coniah is another, and so is Jeconiah, another form of Jehoiakim. If you rearrange these letters, Jehoiakim is the same person as Coniah, or Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah. After Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried into exile Jeconiah, the son of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, and the princes of Judah, and the craftsmen and the builders of bulwarks from Jerusalem, he carried them into exile that he might bring them to Babylon. Verse 2, as for the one basket, the figs were very good, like early figs. And as for the other basket, the figs were very bad, so that they could not be eaten for badness. And Jehovah proceeded to say to me, what are you seeing, Jeremiah? So I said, figs, the good figs being very good, and the bad ones being very bad, so that they cannot be eaten for badness. Then the word of Jehovah occurred to me, saying, this is what Jehovah, the God of Israel, has said. Like these good figs, so I shall regard the exiles of Judah, whom I will send away from this place to the land of the Chaldeans in a good way. And I will set my eye upon them in a good way, and I shall certainly cause them to return to this land. And I will build them up, and I shall not tear down, and I will plant them, and I shall not uproot. And I will give them a heart to know me, that I am Jehovah. And they must become my people, and I myself shall become their God, for they will return to me with all their heart. Now, you should know, I did read 1 Samuel 20 to prepare it. I read the whole chapter. I read it myself. So I do encourage you to read it for yourself. But it is a big task we are undertaking to do, to read all of these scriptures every single day. And we have, I'm not trying to avoid it, but it's not like, it's not the only way to convey the information. We can talk about it and translate it into common English of today by just talking about it and relating the information, and we don't need to necessarily read. It's not necessary to know every word that was in the original text, although I think it is necessary for someone who is interested, but even for all young people to have been exposed to it once, to at least read it and decide whether they want to continue reading it in the future and so on, and whether they want to be... find out what benefit they can get from reading it. That's an important thing. And like the bad figs, verse 8, that cannot be eaten for badness, this is in fact what Jehovah has said. So I shall give Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and his princes, and the remnant of Jerusalem who are remaining over in this land, and those who are dwelling in the land of Egypt, I will also give them over for quaking, for calamity in all the kingdoms of the earth, for reproach and for a proverbial saying, for a taunt and for a malediction in all the places to which I shall disperse them. And I will send against them the sword, the famine, and the pestilence, and they will come to their finish off the ground that I gave to them and to their forefathers. Zedekiah, who was at the time of this having been written by Jeremiah, because Nebuchadnezzar was attacking the city, and Zedekiah was the king of Judah. At the time, he was the king of, who lived in Jerusalem. He was the king of the present moment, Zedekiah. And he was not given any approval by Jehovah, but he was not going out to the king of Babylon as Jehovah had recommended either. Like the good figs, I shall regard the exiles of Judah, whom I will send away from this place. Right. But Zedekiah was not considered part of the group of good figs, or the basket of good figs. He was in the basket of bag. He was considered part of the basket of bad figs. The remnant of Jerusalem. Remnant is sometimes a good thing. And in this case, it's not a good thing. Okay. So there are two groups of people, good and bad ones, talked about here in Jerusalem. That's the end of Jeremiah chapter 24. That's a good illustration, or it's an interesting illustration, is it not, of how Jehovah illustrated the, what do you call them, the besieged people of Jerusalem. They were under siege. I think I was going to read either Matthew 1 or Luke 1, if we have time. We don't really have time, do we? 4 minutes. Can we read this in 4 minutes? Well, I think we should read, yeah, the book of the history of Jesus Christ, Matthew chapter 1, son of David, son of Abraham. Let's read at least the genealogy here. Abraham became father to Isaac. Isaac, this is fascinating, from the Bible, verse 2, Abraham became father to Isaac. Isaac became father to Jacob. Many of us know this. Jacob became father to Judah and to his brothers. There were 12 sons of Jacob. Judah became father to Perez and to Zerah by Tamar. She had twins. Perez became father to Hezron. Hezron became father to Ram. Ram became father to Amminadab. Amminadab became father to Nahshon. Nahshon became father to Salmon. Salmon became father to Boaz by Rahab. Boaz became father to Obed by Ruth. Obed became father to Jesse. Jesse became father to David the king. And we've said before that this is not likely a direct descendancy with no missing generations. There are probably missing generations there. Very likely. David became father to Solomon by the wife of Uriah. Solomon became father to Rehoboam. Rehoboam became father to Abijah. Abijah became father to Asa. And there's another Abijah who lived at the time of Jesus, or John the Baptist, or both. Abijah became father to Asa. Asa became father to Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat became father to Jehoram. We're very probably going to read about all these kings. Jehoram became father to Uzziah. Uzziah became father to Jotham. Jotham became father to Ahaz. Ahaz became father to Hezekiah. Hezekiah became father to Manasseh. Manasseh became father to Amon. Amon became father to Josiah. We've talked about Josiah, during whose reign Jeremiah also prophesied. Josiah became father to Jeconiah. There's Coniah, or Jeconiah, also called Jehoiakim, and to his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. It was at the capture of Jehoiakim that many of the Jews were taken to Babylon. That's the first exile in 597 BCE. After the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah became father to Shealtiel. Shealtiel became father to Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel became father to Abiud. So the exile to Babylon was only 70 years. That's like two generations. So from, we see that. Jeconiah, father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, father of Zerubbabel. That's two generations. And then they came back. And Zerubbabel was one who led them when they came back also to Jerusalem. And so that fits perfectly well with the two generations that they were gone to Babylon. Zerubbabel became father to Abiud. Abiud became father to Eliakim. Eliakim became father to Azor. We're almost out of time. Azor became father to Zadok. Zadok, father to Achim. Achim, father to Eliud. Eliud, father to Eleazar. Eleazar, father to Mathan. Mathan, father to Jacob. Jacob, father to Joseph, the husband of Mary. It doesn't say he's the father of Jesus, because Jesus was born to a virgin, Mary. Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. Born of Mary and implanted by Holy Spirit, who is called Christ. That's all for today. We're done, yeah. It fit perfectly in the time, which is good. It's November 20th, 2023, 22:12 hours Eastern Standard Time is the time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And this is Crow. And this is Cassie on my behalf saying bye for now.